All right, Brad is back in a new incarnation for the After Dark.
I accidentally cleaved my skull on the break. I slipped and fell, cleaved my skull right down to the breastplate, and
The show is going to be twice as interesting now.
Right.
The things that we do for good radio.
Yeah,
old-timey radio. We're mass communicating. Hey, that was fun, man. What an interesting character. I feel bad for him. I didn't realize that he was so tortured.
Yeah, I kind of realized. I realized you didn't know much about him, and I was like, I'm not going to say anything about the death, the suicide, until the end, because it is kind of surprising. Yeah,
it does. Yeah, it is, and it isn't somehow. Yeah, it's just so strange, you know. And there's not that much of a distance between now. I know a lot of things happened.
Right,
a particularly big war happened between 1930 and 1980, but like. It's only 50 years between 1930 and 1980. It's 40 years between 1980 and now.
Right.
Like 82, you know, it's like,
yeah,
it just, it, the mind kind of reels when you think about that. I mean, this dude could have lived to see 1982 Conan the Barbarian. He could have, you know, but he didn't.
Yeah. He could have had, potentially a kid that was still alive now.
Oh yeah. No doubt.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Collecting checks, baby.
Right.
Collecting checks. You got that. There you go. I mean,
well, that was interesting. One thing we didn't get into, just got, you know, thinking about what to leave in, what to leave out. He left the literary estate to like his friend. And then his friend, like, there was a period where like nobody knew what to do with it. It was like, well, okay, fine. Like, because you have to think, like, if you don't know, you didn't know there was going to be a Conan the Barbarian movie and it was going to be this whole thing. It's just like, all right, this guy left me a bunch of his weird stories. What do I do? Like, what do I do with this? It got left to another person. And then like it got left to a dentist and he left it to their kids. And like, it's just an interesting sort of, it almost got kind of lost. It very easily could just be still, you'd have to, you know, go find a musty copy of Weird Tales to read it. Yeah.
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 Cool, dude. So, what an interesting pick too. I really admire your choice of doing this guy. Why did you want to do him? Because he's not, he's a big deal to certain people, but he's not like, you know.
And honestly, I didn't grow up reading him or anything. I read some of the comic books when I was a kid, but I read a lot of comic books. I knew that he committed suicide at 30, and that always kind of piques the interest. Like, what's that? I want to know what led to that. And, you know, we kind of touched on it in the main episode. I'm really, over time, becoming more and more interested in how pulp and the Weird Tales thing fits into, like, American culture. Like, just, it's significant. And there's a lot of people influenced by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people reading these stories every week by Robert E. Howard and Lovecraft and others. And that influence seeped in, and then most of us kind of forget about it somehow. So it feels interesting to tap into that. I've come to think that the American pulp scene before World War II is actually like a very significant chapter in American letters. So. Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
I mean, and in another world, you could do an entire podcast, and I'm sure there are podcasts just about pulp and just about that thing. That's one of the things I love about our concept for our show is that we can put all of our interests into this. Like, if we want to do a 6-month UFO arc for Art of Darkness, we could do it. We would we would cover LRH. We'd cover the Love and Rockets guy. What's that guy's name? The rocket.
Yeah.
The guy who blew himself up.
Jack Parsons. Yeah.
Parsons. Yeah. I mean, we could just do it. But that's the thing I love about this show. You know, we maybe, I don't know. I mean, you know, people seem to want to have like niche shows, right? Oh, this is the show about serial killers. You know, so we go a little wide, but I don't know, man. I love that because it never gets boring, right?
No, it doesn't. And, you know, probably next year, for next year, I might pick another pulp writer, or maybe some of the precursors to the pulp, like Ambrose Bierce or Machin or somebody like that. And it'll be the one off. And, you know, if somebody's really into pulp, it'll be like, holy shit, these guys good. Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard and Clark Ashton Smith. Cool. Awesome.
Sure. I mean, and even our guy from Twilight Zone.
Rod Serling.
Rod Serling's right in that group.
He was definitely reading Weird Tales. I'm sure he read those. It didn't come up in the episode, but I would put money on him being quite familiar with the Weird Tales crowd. So getting into this, I mistakenly referred to this the story I wanted to talk about as The Last Race. He wrote a story called The Lost Race, but the story I wanted to talk about was The Last White Man.
The Last White Man.
Yeah.
Also known as Falling Down.
Right.
You know.
This is, you know, somebody recently, do you remember the Falling Down movie pretty well? Like the general outline of the plot?
Fairly well, yeah.
So somebody was mentioning, and I had kind of intuited this, but hadn't put it together. One of the things that was always disappointing to that movie was in like the third act, it turns out that he's like crazy, like clinically.
Mm.
And there's something disappointing about it, because what was so attractive about it was like, this was a normal guy that finally had enough. Right.
Yeah.
That was kind of the cool. And somebody was like, that movie's a fucking psyop, because what he's trying to say is like, if you don't like this, all this crap going on around you, you're crazy.
Mm.
And it's like, huh? Okay.
Hmm.
But I remember watching that movie and not liking that aspect of it. Like, why does he have to be? Why can't he be? To me, it's more narratively interesting that he's a normal guy.
I just wonder if it would ever have been made if that hadn't been.
Probably not.
You know what I mean? I mean, you could maybe do it. There was a rewrite. Yeah.
You could do it on an indie scale, but you couldn't do it with like Michael Douglas opening in every theater in the country scale, probably.
It still feels like a pretty subversive film.
It is. It still is. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Anyway, The Last White Man. We'll just talk about this a little bit.
The last white man. He's the final roadie for Metallica.
Yeah, right.
He still thinks he's like, it's a cargo cult. He's still setting up Metallica's equipment.
Yeah, right.
That's really funny. The band's dead. Nobody's coming to the show.
Yeah.
The Last Juggalo. The Last Chud. That's a hell of a title, dude. All right, let's see what you got.
Well, dude, so, you know, one of the reasons I did want to touch on this, but I wanted to keep it for this part of the show, just because it's, you know, we talked about this. You know, I think Robert E. Howard starts out as a intelligent and historically aware, but very provincial guy in the middle of nowhere, Texas. And so he has some of the rage. I always think about the Bill Burr bit, I don't know, in one of his specials where he's talking about the Duck Dynasty guys. And there was a bit where it turned out that one of the Duck Dynasty guys said something like racist or something. And Bill Burr's like, he describes the Duck Dynasty guy, you know, he's born in 1948. He lived here this year. He's like, what did you think he thought? You know, he grew up, everybody was telling him racist shit, and he, you know, he turns around and they're all dead. Like, what did you think he thought? It's a little bit of that. Like, mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Mm. So I don't want to delve too far into it, but
people are sheltered.
Right. But dude, I will tell you that. So this, they don't include this story in most of the collections. So I did some Googling, because everything is public domain. All the Robert E. Howard stuff is public domain now. And I'm just searching, and I click on a link, and I don't even think about what website I'm going to, because I've done this before with trying to find stuff. You get the first link, and is that it? Whatever. And I end up on nationalvanguard.org.
I had never heard
of before.
Okay. Oh, Brad's discovering new things, friends.
Yeah, I'm going to just recommend don't go on that website at work. Find another source.
There it is. Okay. Yeah. Okay. There it is.
So
this has it all.
Yeah. God. God, man.
Here's an article. Whatever happened to hitchhiking?
Oh, well, that's okay.
Oh,
That's
oh,
okay.
oh. And then there's the Austrian corporal, and here's the title of the article. What if he was right? Okay, we're
Oh,
going
good Lord.
Right, we're going right into it. I understand. I understand what I'm. Okay.
Yeah. You're an adult. Fun. You can handle clicking on
they have
that
a
without.
Church. They have a church.
There's a National Vanguard church.
That's what it says. They've got a cosmotheism. Okay. All right. I'm closing this. I should have used
don't.
Incognito window.
Yeah. No. You don't want. You don't.
Yeah.
You don't want this. Okay. But I'm gonna just read the first, I don't know, page or so of the last white man.
Cool.
Quote, the man shivered in the coolness of the early morning. He shifted his body to relieve the pressure on his elbows. Cautiously, he peered up over the great boulder in front of him and down the mountainside. Fire twinkled there, and the man cursed. An obscene song floated up to him, and his curses deepened. The song was in a rich, guttural voice. The man was a wonder physically, over 6 feet tall in height. His chest and shoulders were those of a giant, weighing far over 200 pounds. There again, we get that 6 foot, 200 pound thing. Weighing far over 200 pounds, yet gave the impression of sinuous speed. His face was sullen, savage, almost primitive. Small black eyes glittering through tangled strands of sandy hair. In one hand, he clutched a rifle. A curved scimitar of surprising proportions lay beside him. He was a splendid example of a wonderful race. A race which breached physical perfection, sank to the depths of degeneracy, and then regained the heights just before their fall. He was the last. He was thinking as he lay there watching the camps of his enemies. What heights his race had reached before luxuries, idleness, and pleasures had sapped their might, had made of them a race of degenerate weaklings. He cursed beneath his breath. There had been an age when his race had ruled the world. Their cities dotted the fertile plains. Their ships had furrowed the seas, bringing back the wealth of every land. Their armies had gone forth conquering and subjugating. None could stand before them in the more peaceful sports. Their athletes defeated all others with ease. They were all giants physically and mentally. Then the decadence set in. It had been first noticeable in the sports and athletics. Fewer and fewer of the race had gained fame in the great games. More and more men of other races seized the prize. The ruling race forgot the art of war, forgot all except the search for newer pleasures, and in so doing, they descended to the depths of degeneracy. Always some new strong race sprang up then. The man reflected, thinking of the hazy legends of the ancients, of great empires known as Greece, Rome, Nineveh, Samaria, and a new strong race had risen, a race whose people had been enslaved for ages. They were a mighty, prolific race. First, they overran their own continent. Rebellion swept Africa. The Negroes pushed the Arab races to the north, and the Arabs and Europeans slew each other until from Cape Town to Tangiers and from Kimberley to Suez, only black men ruled. The whites should have seen that they could not stand before them. The black race doubles itself in 40 years, the brown in 60, the white in 80, and the white race was exhausted by dissipation. Birth rate almost ceased. Moreover, the race was decimated by fierce wars wherein white man fought white man. Okay, I can't read any more of that. So
when did he wrote that? When he was like 18?
He was like 18 years old.
Damn.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like his own little... Turner Diaries, kind of.
It is.
But very sort of macro, zooming out. Again, man, people are still, this is still the discourse right now. It's not like an original thought, and it's going to persist. No. I mean, it's in there.
Yeah. It's out there. I didn't want to ignore it. It's there. It's part of the narrative.
It's Art of Darkness.
Right. It's Marge, but this is also Juvenalia.
Right.
I think like you have to, the other thing is we do have to give, I think, each other room to evolve in our thinking to some degree, I think. And he wouldn't have written this when he was 30.
For real. I mean, right. And if your entire body of writing, whether under an anonymous account, your own account, anything that's in the drawers going all the way back to the time you were 18 was suddenly made public.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that there's something, but there'd be some embarrassing shit.
I don't have this, but
I don't have anything like that.
Shit.
Yeah. There'd be some embarrassing shit. Yeah, for sure.
Now I want to talk about what
the key is to stop writing the embarrassing shit.
Yes.
That's my writing advice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stop writing garbage.
Yeah. Well, I may have told you this before, but if I haven't, it's good and it inspired me. So Ira Glass, who does This American Life, I once saw a little thing for him trying to like give writing advice. And he said, like, the reason you got into writing is probably, or one of the reasons you got into writing is probably because you have good taste. in stories, right? And what happens for most people is you've got very good taste and then you try something and what you write does not live up to your own taste because it's hard, right?
Yes, yes.
And most people just say, I'm no good at this.
Right.
And the secret is you have to like push past that and work to bring the writing up to your taste, right?
This is very similar to something that I say frequently and I'll try to make it succinct, but it's that when you're a young writer, all you've been exposed to is the greatest work of literature by the greatest writers working with the greatest editors.
Right.
And all you're reading, almost without exception, when you're reading serious literature, are masterpieces that have made their way into the library, that have made their way into the so-called canon.
Right.
Nobody will share their Juvenalia with you. Nobody says, hey, you're really into Steinbeck, read his Juvenalia, because you can always go on, oh, I finished Steinbeck, now it's time to read Faulkner, now it's time to read Hemingway.
Right. Why would you spend your time?
Why would you waste? There's always another masterpiece to read. But what sucks for the young writer in that case is that then you're never exposed to, oh, Steinbeck's Juvenalia is garbage.
Right.
Like,
right.
you know, it's mediocre anyway. So just know, you know, you've got to write your way through that garbage.
You do.
If you're ever going to have anything, you know.
Yeah. And it's hard to. It really is. It's discouraging, you know, to like see your own stuff and be like, this is not good.
Yikes. Yeah. Another way around it is just to be entirely fucking delusional. That can help too, because that can get you to a certain level where you just go, you know, everything I spit out is brilliant. That can actually work for a minute.
For a minute. I'll tell you what, man, to write a novel, you got to be a little bit delusional.
You got to be crazy.
Just because, like, who the fuck is the point of spending all this time on this?
And even now, you know, it would be a wild success if you sold 10,000 copies.
It'll never pay for its time. And any, like, the math never fucking works out on it. So you do have to be like a little cuckoo. Okay. So I got reading about this Hyborian Age stuff, and I was going to spend a little more time on that in the main episode. I hope I was able to convey kind of what his project was there. But I get reading it. And, okay, he's got Atlantis in there. That's cool. He's got Lemuria in there. For people who don't know, that's another one of these sort of like ancient lost civilization myths, right? And he ends up having like a number of other things. He has Aryans in there. And Aryans were a real historical group, but they're sort of lost in mythology. People are kind of confused a little bit about what that group actually was because of the whole Nazi thing, right? And I just got thinking, like, a lot of this is super, like, it's super familiar. And then coincidentally, I was listening to my favorite, my current favorite UFO podcast, and she got talking about Helen P. Blavatsky, people who might know her as one of the founders of Theosophy.
And we got to do Madame Blavatsky.
Yeah, that would be cool. That would be cool.
That's got to happen.
Yeah. And she's talking about, okay, well, what's in the secret doctrine? And I've never dove that deep into the secret doctrine. I don't really know what's in there. And so this podcast host, Down the Rabbit Hole UFO podcast, quite good. And she's talking about Helen P. Blavatsky, and the deal with Helen P. Blavatsky, just super quick, is that she, born in 1931, she claimed that she had traveled basically across the world in search of truth, found her way to Sagatsi, Tibet, where she was trained by masters of ancient wisdom. And one of the things that these masters of ancient wisdom gave her was the insight into the seven root races that comprise the world. So it's effectively esoteric Buddhism in a lot of ways. And she's listing off what the races are. Okay, the first one is etheric. Okay, whatever. The second one is Hyperborean. My ears perked up, right? Hyperborean. The third one is Lemurians. Wait a second. The fourth one is the Atlanteans. And then the fifth one is the Aryans. All of the root races show up in Robert E. Howard's Hyboria, and there's other ones too. But let's go through I'm going to go through these a little quickly. And this race stuff is a little complicated. There are people who will like come out and say, "Well, she wasn't saying anything racist." She kind of was, and we're going to talk about that too. But here,
let me give you... I have it on good authority. If you want to get on Twitter and discuss quote-unquote race science, there are a few counts that'll help you.
Right.
That's
right.
not oh this show.
No, no, it's not. No, nah, it's not at all.
Brad's it's like, this is so complicated. Well, Brad, don't worry. It's not our beat. You're doing
it's not. It's not our beat. It's not,
not
our beat.
Not our beat. Not our beat. But yeah. I'm glad that you're bringing this up. This Blavatsky stuff is so fascinating. And
it really and yeah. he had to have read this stuff. He had to have read The Secret Doctrine. Okay. So I'm going to just run you quick through the seven root races. And the idea is that the universe is constantly evolving. And so you start with one root race and you build to the next, and a little bit of the previous root race survives. So the first one is ethereal, bodiless beings who reproduce like amoeba. Fine. The second one is the Hyperboreans. These are golden yellow in color. They're from the north, Canada, Greenland, Scandinavia. And this is a budding of material beings. Then we get the Lemurians, who exist in the Indian Ocean. These people would have existed historically coexisted with dinosaurs. The early phases of the Lemurians apparently laid eggs, according to Helen Blavatsky. Descendants of these people in traditional theosophy would be various African, South Asian, and Australoid races. The fourth root race are the Atlanteans from Atlantis, and including the subraces of Cro-Magnon, the original Semites / Phoenicians, the Mongolians, and the Toltecs. Toltec is the theosophist synonym for the ancestors of the American Indians. Robert E. Howard would sometimes use this term Toltecs in his Weird Western stories, and we'll read a little passage about that. According to classical theosophy, the height of Atlantis was in fact when the Toltecs ruled. So in Blavatsky's root race secret doctrine stuff, the people who ruled Atlantis were the ancestors of the Native American tribes. I mean, everybody is ultimately the ancestors.
They're just pulling the shit out of their hat, man. Yeah, totally. They're just making this shit up.
No, the secret teachers in Tibet told her this.
Sure, right. It's always the hidden masters.
Right, right.
Yeah, nobody else I have to find the hidden masters. Yeah, right. The hidden masters are going to help our podcast get more traction.
I hope so. That'd be sweet. If anybody knows one of the hidden masters,
have them ring us up. Although nobody calls anymore, so I don't know.
Right, right, yeah, right. Yeah. I have to take my phone off. Do not disturb. Yeah, let me know. Yeah.
I'm throwing my phone into the sewer. For Lens.
Excellent. Smart. That's a good idea.
Sounds like a good idea.
I dropped a phone in a sewer one time. Didn't go well. Where was I? And Atlantis, the height of Atlantis, run by the Toltecs. They had aqueducts and airships and socialism and powerful high-tech armies and magic and all of it, right? The Aryans are the fifth root race, and this is most people alive now, except, and this is where it gets pretty weird. So hey, buckle up. Blavatsky connects physical race with spiritual attributes constantly through her works. Here we go. Quote, the intellectual difference between the Aryan, and this is Blavatsky's words, the intellectual difference between the Aryan and other civilized nations and such savages as the South Sea Islanders is inexplicable on any other grounds. No amount of culture nor generations of training in civilization could raise such human species as the Bushmen, the Vedas of Ceylon, and some African tribes to the same intellectual levels as the Aryans, the Semites, and the Turanians, so-called. The sacred spark is missing in them, and it is they who are the only inferior race on the globe, now happily fast dying out. Verily, mankind is of one blood, but not of the same essence. We are the hothouse, artificially quickened plants in nature, having in us a spark which in them is latent. Now, there were two more root races. And they do not yet exist. Apparently, one of them, the next root race, is according to the secret doctrine, the sixth subrace of the Aryan root race will begin to evolve in the United States in the early 21st century. So keep a lookout. If you see a new sub root race developing, you know, let us know.
Right, get into Telegram. Well, you're already on Patreon, so odds you're seeing auras, you're picking up on it's the Indigo Children.
They will possess certain psychic powers. The pituitary body will be developed, thus giving them additional senses, including that of recognizing astral emotions in ordinary waking consciousness. So, okay. You know anybody who's rolling like that?
Sounds like Art of Darkness fans to
it
me.
It does. Yeah. You guys.
We're the eighth root race. Weird.
Yes. Yeah.
It's so strange. What a weird thing to just. Where is she coming up with these ideas?
Right. I think a lot of it is
high on opium.
Well, it's not like she didn't come up with Atlantis, right? And she didn't come up with. She didn't come up with Lemuria. It's a lot of like syncretism, just like pulling together whatever, right?
Right, right.
And yeah.
We got to do a Blavatsky episode.
That would be really good.
I want to understand because she's right there at the center of, she's like the Gertrude Stein of the woo-woo occult stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's influenced all of these people for sure. Yeah. And they're, you know, I definitely think it was interesting because I was reading a story called, what is that story called? Didn't I have it right here? There's a, here's a little thing. I had a couple notes about suicide too, I know this is a little just slapped together, but this is a few things on Robert E. Howard's suicide, a couple other sort of brush strokes we can bring in. Let's see. Okay. He says this in a letter. Quote, light, he's talking about writing, right? And this is in his autobiographical novel, Post Oaks and Sand Ruffs. And he says in the novel, quote, life is full of tag ends which never begin and never end. There's no plot, no sequence, no moral. How are you going to write such stuff as that so it'll sell? I think that's an interesting conundrum for a writer. And then here's a letter he wrote to Farnsworth Wright in 1924. Every now and then one of us finds out, he's talking about other writers. And Farnsworth Wright had asked him for biographical information. They were going to do a little blurb about him as a person, right? And Robert E. Howard said this to say, quote, every now and then one of us finds the going too hard, that is right, the writing going, and blows his brains out. But it's all in the game, I reckon. There is a story, and this is a pretty good one. It's a little hard to find, but it's a pretty good story. This is called The Valley of the Lost, and this is one of his weird westerns. And it's the only story where a character commits, I think it's the only story where a character commits suicide, certainly where the protagonist commits suicide. And it's about a feud in Texas, like back in the gunslinger days, between the McCrill family and the Reynolds family. And John Reynolds ends up shooting one of the McCrills, and the McCrill gang puts the body of this McCrill guy he killed in what's called the Ghost Cave, which all the native tribes have avoided for years, right? And he's still got some ammunition on him, and John Reynolds is down to his last round. So when the gang sneaks off, he sneaks into the cave, and he's going to get the ammunition so he can continue the gunfight. But as soon as he enters into this like time warping portal, and he's first is attacked by the zombie resurrected McCrill guy, fights that guy off. And then he ends up witnessing the entire history of this cave from like ancient times when the Toltec lived there. And there was like in a super advanced society tens of thousands of years ago in Texas, and he observes it all the way to the present day. It's this like grand sweep of history. And then at the end, what he is seeing is that the heart of it is this demonic worm, effectively, is somehow controlling all of this, is at the heart of the Ghost Cave and radiating evil. And after John Reynolds has seen this thing, this evil at the core of history, he blows his brains out. So, yeah. Check out that one. If that sounds appeals to you, that's The Valley of the Lost. Like I said, that one is actually kind of hard to find. I don't think it's on Project Gutenberg. Most of the Robert E. Howard stories are on Project Gutenberg, pretty easy to find. But that one is buried in the archives. So, yeah, that's pretty much all I got. I hope people enjoyed that. I know some Robert E. Howard stans are going to find us. I am not a person who grew up steeped in this stuff, so I was learning a lot along the way. I hope I did him justice. And for people who are just Art of Darkness fans listening, I hope you got a good story about an interesting feller.
And another suicide.
Yeah.
Boy, oh boy. Fascinating. Yeah. I never would have guessed the guy who wrote Conan the Barbarian would blow his brains out because his mother ended up in a coma. That is surprising.
Right. Yeah, I could see him like late in life having like a terminal disease and just being like, fuck it. You know,
yeah, for whatever reason, I would have imagined this guy. Yeah, maybe he's from Texas, but he ended up in Hollywood is what I would have imagined. But no, he did not. I'm really interested in this story. Very fascinating. You told us some weird tales, Brad. And
good.
I always appreciate it. I know how much work goes into it. Thank you, patrons. We appreciate it. Hope y'all are having a good start to your year. For those who observe, I hope you have a very blessed and meditative and prayerful Lent. For those who don't, I just hope you're having a wonderful, like I said, start to your year and everything's going well and you're enjoying the podcast. We want to hear from you all too. I mean, we know you're listening. So if you want to make a suggestion, you have a subject you want us to cover, you know where to find us, and get ready for Wise Blood coming up on February 24th, is it?
February 24th, correct.
Yep. And that'll be, we'll post a link to that for the book club, and join us. It'll be good to see everybody. It's been a few months.
Yeah. I know you've started reading it a little bit. Just Kevin, first impressions. Don't have to go too in depth, but
it's just very drippy. It's very Southern. It's very sweaty. It's very American. Yeah. It's not a book that I would pick up otherwise at this point in my life. There was a period where I kind of went down this rabbit hole and then I stopped, but I love that it's motivated me to do that. It's a very strange thing to go from like Dante and Hesse over to here, because it's just such an American style. And there's so many cultural assumptions that are just like, if you aren't familiar with like America, I could see how people might read this and miss a lot. Just as I'm sure that I miss a lot that's going on in Hesse, because I'm not German or Swiss and it's in translation, but I almost kind of resent how American it is at times. I'm like, God damn it.
Right.
We never figure this out. We never get,
right.
It never changes. We're still the same people we were 80, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Acting out the same trauma and the same anxieties and the same nihilistic, narcissistic individualism, but having to do so in order to survive. That's kind of what I'm getting from the novel.
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah. I like it. I vibe with all that. One of the things that I appreciate about it is like just the blackness of the comedy of it. Just the, like, when it's funny, it hurts somehow that it's funny to me. Like it elicits a very peculiar emotional response to me at certain times. It's like, I kind of hate Hazel Motes, but I also care about him for some reason. Like, he's a child. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like witnessing a child have a temper tantrum and you feel bad for it. Sort of, you know, you're like, oh dude, just relax. Just take some deep breaths.
Totally.
Yeah. So
it's a good pick, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty quick read. I mean, I don't know. It's
9,200 pages. Yeah, it's like 150. Pages, so. Yeah, it's not even. Yeah. Yeah. Read it. Read Wise Blood. Yeah. Join us at the book club. All the details are at artofdarkpod.com. And we'll post the link the day of or the day before on Patreon and or Substack. So now we got to call out Substack people. Yeah. Thank you. Patreon people, you don't have to change anything. Substack people, welcome to the party. Hopefully that goes well. Brad, I'm going to post this and then you post it immediately on Substack.
Will do. All right.
Hey, congrats. Another good episode. I know it's a lot to put these in, dude. Yeah. We've been preparing that for a minute. So thank you.
Well, thanks for riding with me. That was fun.
You got it, buddy. All right. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.